Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 59, recorded Wednesday, November 21st, 2007. This is the podcast giving the voice to the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. We have two topics on today's Travel Commons Podcast: trains to planes and renting a rambling wreck. Well, this week, coming to you today from the Travel Commons studios outside of Chicago, Illinois, in the middle of the 1 week a year I refuse to travel, Thanksgiving Day week. The surge of, I don't want to say amateurs, so let me say the surge of less experienced travelers makes my sort of usual hangouts, O'Hare, San Francisco Airport, LaGuardia, Newark, less inviting than usual. And it's not like nature or fate is trying to make it easy this week. Monday saw two-hour weather delays at O'Hare and LaGuardia and a slightly lesser delay at Dallas-Fort Worth because of the airport's two control towers couldn't communicate with one another. Now, I see that definitely being a problem. And Tuesday had all of Southern California socked in with heavy marine layer fog, and the East Coast had 1 to 2 hour weather delays. And today, rain, and for the really lucky ones, a little bit of snow. That's going to cover the eastern half of the U.S. today. Now, starting off in the morning, looks like things aren't too bad, but I'll tell you, it could potentially just be, sort of perfect conditions, for an already overloaded air traffic system now to try to carry a 20% volume surge. Again, seems like a good time to stay home. And for my colleagues who are flying home today out of Chicago to places like Rochester, New York, and Salt Lake City, we've got a whole string of sort of over and under bets on who's actually going to make it to the dinner table on Thursday. I'm happy I've just got a 30-minute drive on Thursday that doesn't even have to involve a freeway if I don't want it to. Following up, in the last episode, Travel Commons number 58, I talked about a meaningless apology email I received from United Airlines the day after taking a 2.5 hour delay from DCA, Washington National Airport, to O'Hare. Pamela Coslett, Senior Manager Customer Relations, wrote to tell me that United felt bad about the delay and is working hard to ensure your next trip is better, but didn't have much more to say. So last week, my United flight from LAX to O'Hare took a 3 hour delay, 90 minutes to fix the broken 767, an hour waiting for maintenance to get the right paperwork to the pilot, and then another 30 minutes at LAX runway congestion. The next morning, I opened my email to find yet another note from Ms. Coslett. Dear Mr. Peacock, you fly with us too often for us to let you down. We feel very fortunate to have you as a customer and sincerely want to feel like you are welcomed guest when you travel with United. Your recent experiences did not reflect the service you deserve, and I'm sorry for that. Since your most recent flight from Los Angeles to Chicago on November 12, 2007 resulted in a delay, I have credited your Mileage Plus account with 5,000 miles and as an expression of our gratitude for your business. We are committed to providing you with what you want and should certainly expect, a travel experience that is seamless, makes you feel respected, and one that rewards you for your ongoing loyalty to United. Well, okay then, 5,000 miles is a bit of a step up from the last note, and an apology and a nice I'm sorry present. However, I'll tell you what I would have really liked, and this is not to diminish the 5,000 miles, but I'll tell you, I would have really liked to have the maintenance guy responsible for getting the paperwork to the pilot. I would have liked him to get on the plane, stand up in front of all the passengers who had been cooling their jets for an hour, and have him explain why we had to wait for him to hit the print button and find his way to the plane. For that, I would have given up 5,000 miles. Bob Fennerty stopped by the Travel Commons website, and he left a comment about the power in airports topic that was in the last episode. Bob writes, "The lack of available power in airports and airplanes continues to frustrate me. At Dulles yesterday, I scored a dual outlet next to my gate only to discover that it was dead. I had an American Airlines business class seat with a dead outlet a few months ago. I've done time at those round Verizon stools you mentioned, sitting with no back support under the stare of desperate ThinkPad owners waiting for me to close the lid. I struck up a conversation with the fellow typing next to me and was quickly and understandably chastised by waiting users. I now travel with three batteries, two extended and one for the CD-ROM slot. It lets me hot swap without shutting down the box." You know, I'll tell you, I liked Bob's observations about the sort of emerging power station etiquette. I used a couple of nice Samsung-sponsored stand-up power stations at LAX on my connections to and from Palm Springs last weekend. They were bar-height tables with no round stools. You know, they definitely were made more for a quick email check than a longer-term work session. There was an etiquette challenge here too, though, all about personal space violations. I use a small laptop, a ThinkPad X60S, and even I was having a hard time fitting onto the small table when all the plugs were being used. I'll tell you though, the guy with the table-hogging widescreen HP rig, I'll tell you, he was catching some heat from the rest of us. The dead outlets in business class seats, though, that's really annoying. On a long flight, you save up work and expect to plug in and crank away. More times than not, though, I've found that someone, the flight attendant or some ground staff, has turned off the seat outlets while the plane was on the ground during cleaning or in that turn. If my outlet's dead, I usually ask the flight attendant to check the switch. Most times that actually ends up working. I'm sure Bob asked that question and he just pulled a short straw. And while we talk about seat power outlets, I'll tell you, one of the things I think that Virgin America has done right is their seat power outlets. Rather than using a cigarette lighter outlet like American or that sort of goofy enable plug like United and Delta, Virgin just uses a regular two-prong 110 outlet that you just, you know, plug into with whatever you got. You know, nothing special, don't have to carry yet another piece of kit. And as a nice bonus, they've got a USB power outlet. So you can charge your PC and your iPod and your BlackBerry at the same time. I mean, it's a nice to have, but it shows a bit of attention to detail on the customer service. And for those of you ripping open the cellophane on your $2 muffin you bought on your flight to Grandma's, Northwestern University Library has just launched web access to their Transportation Library menu collection, which they say includes more than 400 menus from 54 national and international carriers, cruise ships, and railroad companies with coverage from 1929 to the present. That's according to them. Most of the menus are airline menus from George Foster, a Northwestern alum who appears to have taken a lot of first-class flights while working for UNICEF and the World Health Organization. Each page of each menu has been scanned. The lunch menu for a March 1969 United flight from San Francisco to Detroit supports United's red carpet theme with a bright red accent on each page. The beverage list asks passengers to please be our guest and order the United Special Very Dry Martini, gin or vodka. On the facing page, we can see Foster commenting that the poached quenelle of scallops Nantua sauce was excellent. He didn't know whether he chose the broiled filet mignon Bercy sauce or baked Lagostino's Thermidor for his entree. Bit different from the turkey wrap and the cold chicken salad I was offered when upgraded to United's first class a couple of weeks ago. I did get a bit of a chuckle out of the 1962 menu for East Africa Airways. No food, just booze and cigarettes. I tell you, those had to be happening flights. I'll put the links to the website and these two menus in the show notes, but hit that site at your own risk. Browsing those menus won't make you any happier when you're pondering the purchase of that $5 box meal on your next flight. Hey, thanks again to everyone who contributes their thoughts, their stories, sends along audio comments, the voice of the traveler. The email address again is comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com, or you can post them on the website at travelcommons.com. The first topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is trains to planes. Alan Marco, a longtime Travel Commons listener, sent me a note asking my thoughts on the best way to get from Newark Airport to Midtown Manhattan. The answer is, of course, it depends. It depends on time and money. And as usual with those two, it's an inverse relationship. Short on time but long on money, book a private car. It's $100, $120. And the driver is waiting for you downstairs in the baggage claim with your name on a sign, ready to walk you to your car. It's a nice little ego boost and makes you feel right at home. If, however, and by the way, whenever you get into Newark Airport, you need something to help you because, God, I hate that airport. But I digress. If you're on the other side of that sort of time-money spectrum, a lot of time and not much money, taking the train is the way to go. At Newark, though, it means getting on the monorail, riding out past the rental car stops and over the marshes to the last stop, a train terminal dropped in the middle of nowhere. However, from there, you can catch New Jersey Transit trains into the city or Amtrak trains to places south like Princeton. It's a pretty handy setup, but as with many, too many, I think, plane train connections, it's not intuitively obvious, not very user-friendly, at least for first-time users. I've kind of been going out of my way over the past 6 months to use more mass transit to and from airports. I'm not really sure why. I'm traveling on business, and so I'm typically in the short time, long money situation that should have me choosing cabs and private cars, and actually oftentimes does. But when I get a chance, I'll use the train. I'll use mass transit. I don't know. Maybe I'm turning a shade of green and trying to avoid incremental pollution, but over these 6 months, I've found that many plane-train connections seem to be almost trying to discourage use. Getting from Manhattan to JFK requires buying two tickets and transferring trains somewhere in some town called Jamaica halfway along the journey. A bit of a pain if you've got more than one-wheeled suitcase. Now, the train from Center City, Philadelphia to Philadelphia International Airport is a bit better. It's a single shot, but you have to queue with the rest of the city's commuters just to buy a one-way single-shot ticket. You know, no ticket machines in sight. And it's not just a U.S. thing. Taking the train from Frankfurt, Germany to the airport last spring, you know, wasn't any simpler. Waiting on the commuter train platform, hoping we got the train number right. One train passes, then another. We think the third train is the right one. We look around, see some other people boarding with large backpacks, and figure we're okay. The gold standard of the plane-train connections remains the Heathrow Express, the 15-minute nonstop train trip from London Heathrow to Paddington Station. It's well-advertised, easy to find, simple to buy a ticket, and well-staffed. However, you pay for that convenience, about $30 per person per trip. You could take the tube for about a fourth of the price, but the trip would take you about four times as long. There's that time-money trade-off thing again. Between the Heathrow Express and commuter trains, I guess you could put in kind of a silver standard some of the subway systems, Washington, D.C., Chicago, Atlanta, that take you from downtown straight into the terminal for a reasonable price. Now, you still have to schlep your bag between commuters, but the airport stops are clearer, the maps are simpler, it's easier to find, and the fares are even more reasonable than the commuter trains. $1.75 for Chicago from Chicago's Loop to either O'Hare or Midway, $1.85 from Washington, D.C.'s DuPont Circle to Reagan National Airport, just as a couple of examples. Now, I put one thing, if you're familiar with subway systems in the U.S., you go, well, you know, what about San Francisco? What about the BART system? I tell you, I got to put those guys the next tier down, though. It's a pretty straightforward subway system. It's less convenient. You need to take a 5-minute monorail ride from the airport terminal to the station. I mean, you can walk, but most everybody takes the AirTrain. It's more expensive, $5.15 from SFO to the city. And this tops it, it's filthy. I mean, they use the same cars as DC's Metro, but for some odd reason, they put cloth cushions on the seats instead of just leaving it, you know, sort of the normal sculpted plastic like every other subway system on the planet. The last time I rode it, a couple of months ago, every seat was just sort of tacky to the touch. I don't know the last time they actually cleaned those things. It was just disgusting. I think I'll stay with a $30 cab ride in San Francisco. But any plane-train connection, easy or difficult, I'll tell you, they seem more the exception than the rule. And as NIMBYs, the not-in-my-backyard crowd, continue to push for airport construction further and further from city centers, it's not going to get any easier to try and avoid the car or the cab or the limo. I mean, look at where the last new airport in the U.S. was built, Denver, you know, out in the middle of an empty field miles from anywhere. I mean, the taxi meter hits $10 before you're even off airport property. It'll be a while before anybody lays tracks out there, at least 8 years if Denver's Fast Tracks regional transit plan holds. Now, Wikipedia has what looks like a good listing of airport rail links. I'll put a link in the show notes. They actually list a couple of links I haven't tried yet, Minneapolis, Cleveland, Baltimore. You know, all this being said, I think I'll keep taking the train to the plane when I have time. It makes me feel sort of doubly green, greening up a small bit of my already immense carbon footprint by avoiding and putting an incremental automobile on the road, as well as keeping a bit more green in my pocket. The second topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is renting a rambling wreck. You know, I can't remember the last time I had a decent rental car. Last weekend in Palm Springs, I had a Ford Taurus with 27,000 miles that wheezed louder each time I started it up. Last month at Hertz in Dulles Airport, I opened the door of a Chrysler Sebring and just about choked. It reeked of smoke and had a cigarette burn on the driver's seat right between the legs. I'll tell you, somebody must have had a close call there. And the last couple of cars I received from Hertz at San Francisco Airport made me pull a t-shirt out of my bag so I could sit on something clean. Now, you know, what is it about San Francisco Airport or San Francisco and sticky seats? We just talked about it with the BART system, and now here it is with rental cars at the Hertz station. You know, stained seats, soda residue on the center console, ashes in a supposedly non-smoking car. These last couple of cars out of SFO were just disgusting. It's got me wondering if it's just sort of my bad luck with Hertz or the rental car industry is trying to stretch their cars a bit further. You know, an article last month in the Wall Street Journal sort of assuaged my paranoia. And though Hertz claims their fleet age hasn't changed, the owners of National Alamo and Enterprise Rental Car admit that they're letting their fleets age an additional 2,000 miles. My personal experience, I've received more rental cars with over 20,000 miles from Hertz this year than ever before, and that's with, you know, sort of some level of status in Hertz Gold Club. And I'm not the only one noticing this. A follow-up Wall Street Journal article this month lists a significant drop in rental car customer satisfaction, as reported in this year's J.D. Power Rental Car Satisfaction Study. And they link it specifically to the growing mileage of the rental car fleet. Now, for a while, I was switching over to Hertz. I tried that out. I liked the free Wall Street Journal that came with every car, the Wi-Fi hotspots in some of their locations. The cars seemed a little less beat up. However, I'll tell you, my time with Avis came to an immediate halt when they called me about a damaged backup light on a car I'd rented 11 months ago. when I finally received the paperwork from them, I, you know, immediately pointed to the line in the damage report where I had clearly printed, light was damaged when I received the car. Read your own paperwork. I haven't heard from Avis since, but neither have they heard from me nor my credit card. The rental car companies may think these actions are reducing their costs and improving their profit margins, but it's actually costing them revenue, top line sales, at least for me. The potential hassles and the disgusting cars are tilting me toward cabs and limos, and as we talked in the last topic, public transportation. You know, last year, at the tipping point where the cost of a rental car was the same, maybe even a little bit more than the cost of a taxi, I'd take the rental car. I sort of enjoyed the flexibility of having a car and even look forward to finding a fun car in the Avis lot or under the Hertz Gold canopy. I'll tell you though, those days are long gone, and now I'll actually pay extra to avoid the rental cars. The cost of throwing away my impromptu t-shirt seat covers is just getting way too much. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Travel Commons podcast number 59. I hope you all enjoyed this podcast, and I hope you decide to stay subscribed. Even more, I hope you decide to tell a friend about it. The bridge music on today's show is from Magnatunes, the We Are Not Evil label. The songs are Arlos Auto Parts and Salvation by Swivel Neck Jones. You know, I got to tell you, I just love the names of some of these songs and the artists. I have to record them twice because I just start laughing when I read them. So anyhow, Arlos Auto Parts by Swivel Neck Jones, Smiling Perspective by General Fuzz, and Go A Life by Ambient Technology. There you go. They're all available at magnatune.com. Also, check out the show notes for links. So if you have a story, thought, comment, gripe, moans, groans, cries of anguish, the voice of the traveler, especially on this holiday weekend, send them along, text or MP3 file to comments, COMMENTS, travelcommons.com, or post them on our website at travelcommons.com. Thanks to everyone who's taken the time to send in emails, audio files, and to post comments on the website. So thanks to everybody for my fellow Americans. Have a great holiday weekend for those of you outside the U.S. You have a good weekend, and thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. We'll talk again soon. Take care. Bye now.
Life is hell, strange bed in a lonely motel. But one thing can ease my mind, the warm woman that I left behind. From California to Carolina, she calls me up and there's nothing finer. And when the tears start falling, crying.